Thank you. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. And I hope I've covered... last week, I think what I was trying to cover was the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. I hope I did that to satisfaction of the room. And now I'm going to try to bang through a couple of chapters in one hour. Starting with, you know, chapter two, there is a solution. I brought this with me tonight. This is just the cover thing that everybody throws away.
Yeah.
And this was the cover to the third edition, which I bought just for the cover. I had plenty of third editions, but none of these covers ever made it through. And I thought it was interesting. It had been pointed out to me that in the inside, in the dust jacket, it says, but the basic text, pages 1 through 164, remained unchanged in when they published the third edition. This is the AA message. So the AA message is page 1 through 164. And when they talk about carrying the message, I think this is the information that we're supposed to be carrying, as opposed to what's my story, what happened, you know, what was it like, what happened, and what am I like now. That's what everybody thinks the message is, and this is really the message. And how this message relates to me is what I try to come across with. You know, those pocket editions of the big book, I got a bunch of those, and I got a couple old ones that are duct taped and that were sat in my back pocket. And just, and I got to the point after like 15 and 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous that I could sit in an AA meeting, and whatever the discussion meeting was, I could flip to a page and go, here it is, here it is. And I used to do that all the time. And drives me crazy when I can't find the page. You know, where is that? You know, where is this? Where are they talking about this? So, you know, there is a solution. It talks about the ocean liner. It starts off with the ocean liner. We're on page 17 if anybody's looking. And how we wouldn't normally mix. You know, and I mean, that's just a universal truth. I can remember I grew up in Chatham, and when I first came into AA, I can remember going on speaking commitments and being at the Salvation Army in Newark and watching a cockroach crawl up some guy and being like, I hope I wouldn't offend him if I knock it off. You know, and how I got there. My stories, I don't know whether I've shared. I don't know what the hell I said because I haven't listened to any of the tapes, right? But the things that have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, speaking at the Market Street Mission in Morristown one night, and I told this the first week that I'm up there, I'm sharing, and initially it starts like, what the hell am I doing here? I'm in this mission. You know, a lot of these guys are here listening to this just so they can sleep on the floor here tonight, so they're not out there in the cold. Mm-hmm. And they're coming in with their forms to be signed for their probation, and I've spoken at probation, and I go to the prisons and I go to the jails, and the message that I carry is this. A lot of times, this is my guest speaker. You know, we're going to sit down, we're going to read this. That's what we did Friday night. We read AA number 3. Which next week I want to talk about AA number 3 and our Southern friend, and how they're connected back to the very beginning of this, those two stories. But what I want to really focus on is the 12-step calls in those stories, which I mean, it only took me, you know, 33 years to have my mind blown reading those stories. I wouldn't read those stories and, oh, that old shit. Who needs that old stuff? You know, I need that old stuff. I need to go back and be reconnected with the founders. I don't think we made any progress past this. I think we've complicated this. And there is a solution. It says, you know, we would normally not mix. But later in the book, it's going to tell me that love and tolerance is our code. And there's a lot of people that rub me the wrong way. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I can be sitting there grumbling in my head like, son of a, not dull, what you calling on that? Oh, I'm not going to listen to this stuff again. You know, and I talked about it the first week here, that, you know, the people in Berkeley Heights are doing wonderful, wonderful things with their big book study, but the shit I used to listen to at their meetings, kicking the crap out of the fellowship week after week after week after week. I mean, it takes all of these different meetings. All of us need different stuff. Some people need, just don't drink and go to meetings. I've seen a lot of people that need, and they need it right up until that's not working for them anymore. And then they need the next step. They need to be directed to this thing. But when we come in, we're wounded animals. And you know how you treat a wounded animal? Very carefully. Because if you come on too strong, they're going to try to rip you apart. And I hear so many people. We used to have, in my home group, we used to have these two prayers done in calligraphy. Big, big things. And we would come in the morning, and those prayers would be turned to the wall. Because the guy that was running the night meeting, that was the chairperson of the night meeting, was afraid it was going to scare the newcomers away. Now, if they get scared away, booze is going to chase them back in here because there's really no place else to go. But I did have friends that when, as soon as the word God was introduced, they went running for the hills. And I've been saying it for over 30 years. I thank God that I can stomach what we talk about in here, that the word God didn't send me running. And the word God is used a lot in There Is a Solution. And I think, we're still talking about the first step at this point. This is all this information is designed to convince you that you are screwed. Seriously. And that I usually say, use stronger language about it. You're if you are an alcoholic, if when you honestly want, this is getting ahead of myself, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably an alcoholic. If that be the case, you're screwed. You may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. And this has given you enough information to decide, are you or are you not an alcoholic? The first italics that you find is on page 18, where it talks about the ex-problem drinking. You know, it talks about us and our families, how we're not honest with them. We're not honest with psychiatrists. I went to my first therapy appointment this past week. I was as honest as I could possibly be. And he was disconcerted. I'm not more depressed, I think. He thought I had a horrible childhood. I didn't see it. But the ex-problem drinker who has found his solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Everybody in this room, you're divinely crafted to carry this message to another alcoholic. You're divinely crafted. You can carry this message where the greatest PhD in the world can't get across to some guy, and you can come in and you can bridge that gap because you know what you're talking about. You can talk in his language, and that's key point. And I mean, that's step 12, and we're still on the first step here. Time after time, it's saying, you know, this program, it's talking about this program, these steps should be very, this should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned about his drinking problem. This book carries the good news that there is a solution to your drinking problem. You know, we're not going to tell you drink too much. No shit. We're not going to tell you your problem is your drinking. If anybody's telling you your problem was your drinking, get away from them. You know, if I could change one word in the big book, it's in how it works. Remember, we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. There's nothing cunning, baffling, and powerful about alcohol. You put a glass of alcohol here and we go away for a week, we'll come back, it evaporates. There's nothing cunning, baffling, and powerful. Alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Why do I keep picking this stuff up? Why do I keep hurting myself time and time again? Why do I handicap myself with this stuff? Why? Because it's my solution. Before this book, before this chapter, alcohol was my solution. Alcohol allowed me to fit in. I didn't fit in my house, in my home, with my mother and father. I didn't fit in with my family. I didn't fit in at school. I didn't fit in anywhere. And the first time I caught a buzz, I was like, holy shit. This is fixing things I didn't even know were broken. I didn't even understand that I had the problems, and the problems are being solved. That's great when you find the solution the same day you realize you have a problem. All of a sudden, this was wonderful. I could go to the party. People were so excited to see me, where normally I felt like I was being ignored. You know, this time I walk in, hey, Carl's here. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. It's on page 23. The book shifts at page 23. It goes from the physical aspects of alcoholism to the mental aspects. Right? It's saying, you know, we've been knocking the hell out of you with phenomenon of craving. Now, it's not about the physical. Now they're going to talk about the mental. This is where alcoholism lives. This is the circus in my head. I was in a meeting one day, and a guy right behind me puts his hand up and says, I am so stupid. I picked up. I had 6 weeks, and I picked up. And I can't believe how stupid I am. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get a tattoo that says, remember, on here. And the rest of the meeting was, no, don't get remember, get no matter what. No, get don't drink. No, get this. No, get that. Get all, you know, this guy was going to be tatted all up and down his arm. Now, page 24, and I had my hand up. It was one of those meetings that nobody called on me, and I had my hand up the whole meeting, and I'm pissed. I'm like, come on. I want to tell the guy, you're not stupid. You're an alcoholic. Italics on page 24, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force and memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We're without defense against the first drink. I wanted to say, good, there's good news. You're an alcoholic. You're a real alcoholic. You're right here. You can't. Chances are you're not going to look at a tattoo when you've made up your mind to drink. I used to think, there was a guy in one of my first meetings that said, he called his sponsor, he was outside the Washington Tavern in Morristown. Hi, Laura. In Morristown. And he got the idea, he had bought a six-pack, and he called his sponsor to see if it was okay if he just put it in his mouth and then spit it out without swallowing. And I was on the edge of my seat. Like, is that a loophole? Can you do that? There is a solution, and I'm going to end the chapter. The solution is a spiritual solution. I'm going to cut to the chase. They kind of dance around it, but it's a spiritual solution. And they give this wonderful example, which ties into AA history, the American businessman. The American businessman is a man named Roland Hazard. And Roland was the son, the heir to this industrial family's fortune. I don't know that. I don't know his whole story. I've read his stuff. I've read about how he's the man that came to Ebbie Thatcher and pulled Ebbie out from in front of the judge. It was Roland Hazard, it was Shep Cornell, and it was Sebra Graves. Great names, right? Sebra, Shep. what happened to great names like that? And Zebra's father was the judge, so the fix was in, and they pulled some strings and they got Ebby out of the mix. But the big story is Roland. And Roland told Ebby about it. He had gone to Carl Jung, however you want to pronounce it, and he had been sent there because he had been through all kinds of shrinks, all kinds of therapy in the United States, and he continued to pick up, He goes to Jung. He spends a year with this guy, writing checks every month, getting treatment, getting therapy, and at the end of the year, Carl Jung said, "Dude, you're golden, man. You got no urges. God bless you. See you." And he goes to Paris, meets his family, goes out to dinner. I'm assuming this. They ask him, "Do you want white wine or red wine with dinner?" He said, "I want both." Because that's what, when in Paris, you do what the Parisians do. And he comes back within a couple of weeks, schnockered, and, "Hey, I guess it didn't work. I did it again. Let's." And Carl Jung didn't want to look at him. Just said, "My art cannot help you. I was hoping that you were bipolar. I was hoping that you were something other than what you proved to be. You're an alcoholic. You're screwed." In not so many words, he basically said, "Leave. I can't help you." And Roland said, it was like the gates of hell had closed on him. He goes, you're my court of last hope. Are there no exceptions?" And Carl Jung goes, "Well, I don't really, I don't like to tell people this, but do you believe in magic?" How's that? How's that for an answer, huh? How's that for a slip? "Do you believe in hocus pocus? Do you believe in there are some people, I don't understand it, but they have spiritual experiences and their entire psyche is just reorganized and they're able to stand up and they're able to get their act together." But, and Roland goes, "Wait a second. My family gives a lot of money to this church in New York, this Calvary Church. We're Episcopalians. I'm Episcopalian, so rah rah, Episcopals, whatever." So, and Jung goes, "Nah, that doesn't cut it. That doesn't writing checks to the church doesn't cut it. You have to be reorganized. You either have to get this spiritual experience or you have to surround yourself with this type of a community. And hopefully you'll get it." And Roland, the history that I have read, didn't immediately run to the Oxford group, but he ended up in the Oxford group. He had opened up his house in Vermont as some kind of a commune. And as part of his service, this reaching out to other people, he had gone out to Ebby Thatcher. And he had pulled Ebby out, and he had brought Ebby to New York to the Calvary Church, to the Calvary Mission. Ebby was living in the Calvary Mission, feeding beans to the homeless and singing songs to Jesus. If you've never been to the Market Street Mission, you should go. I think it's either Tuesday or Thursday night, or they probably do it every night. But they're up there singing songs to Jesus, and it's like unbelievable. And the people that you're sitting with are, ripe, But these are alcoholics. These are mentally, you walk out of there and you're amazingly lifted up and put back on your feet. And the reason I went there is because an old friend of mine who I had met in AA when I first came in ended up there. And when I was telling my story, he stuck his hand up at the end of my story and goes, "I'm trying to place your face because I just told a story about me and him back in the day. And it blew me away. It blew everybody there away. that the guy I was just talking about, the guy that looked at me and said, when I was saying, how am I going to stay sober for the next 5 years? I almost picked up the other day. How am I going to stay sober for another year? I've been washing coffee pots, picking up ashtrays. I've been going to, you know, 2 meetings a day. And I almost picked up. How am I? And he looked at me. He said, Carl, all you got is 45 minutes. Because it was 10:45. And all we got to do is get to midnight tonight, one day at a time. And what a difference that made. And then here's this guy in the back of the Market Street Mission saying, hey, I'm trying to picture your face. I'm trying to remember. And I go, Peter, oh my God. Boop, 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 boop. And he was the guy that had said that to me that night. That made such a difference in my life. Mm-hmm. Of course, he was smoking pot at the time. Yeah. You know, he wasn't going to. He mentioned to me that he thought it might be a good idea. And back then, I was like, oh, you better not do this. So he stopped mentioning it to me, but continued to do it himself. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately picked up after 7 years. And then he ended up in the Key West homeless shelter. And he had come up to live with his sister. This wasn't supposed to be a Peter meeting, but it is. He lived with his sister in Morris Plains. And she said, if you pick up, I'm dropping you off under the cross, which is the Market Street Mission in Morristown. And he picked up, dropped her off. He's dead now. He went through their program, and he picked up several times. But he had had so much trauma in his life. He had been hit by cars. He had fallen off his bicycle. Just, you know, normal drunk stuff that happens to us along the way. And he was quite a few years younger than me, and he passed away. And when he passed away, I'm like, God, what the hell did you put this guy in my life for? And it was probably to show me that I can't just sit down and throw a big book at some guy and save his life. I can't just buy him a pack of cigarettes once a week and sing songs to Jesus and take him out to dinner. That God's got other plans. And that pointing out to me that I'm not God. That's the how and the why of it. I had to stop playing God. And so Roland doesn't really have a spiritual awakening, but he talks to Ebby, and Ebby goes to Bill Wilson and tells Bill Wilson about what Carl Jung had said. And Wilson put that together with what Dr. Silkworth had said. And at that time, he started going to the Oxford group, and he listened to what they were saying. And my understanding is he used to meet with Sam Shoemaker like once a week. And they used to talk about a lot of things. Everything back then was on a spiritual basis. Except for when he was talking to alcoholics. Then he was talking to people about his hopelessness and about what happened to him. And most of the people are going, what? The room lit up? The hell are you talking about? You felt wind blowing through you? You know, and they used to goof on him. They used to call it his hot flash. Bill's hot flash. They'd say, I was in the other room flipping the light switch when you were having that, you know? And he goes out of his way to kind of soft sell this at this point. But then he knows what's coming up. We Agnostics is coming up. So what he does is he goes into more about alcoholism, which is our third chapter on page 30. More about alcoholism. 4 examples of alcoholic insanity is what this is. And it finally identifies what the first step is. We learn that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step of recovery. Talks about the idea that somehow, someday, I'll be able to control and enjoy my drinking. There was never a time in my life that I was drinking. If I was controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. If I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it. So this is just ridiculous. But this is the delusion of the alcoholic. This is the mental aspects of alcoholism. Someday, maybe, if I put whiskey in my milk and I have a full stomach, it's not going to hurt me on the full stomach. That's Jim, right? And everybody loves to talk about Jim. my favorite guy and the guy I identified with was the man of 30. Man of 30 was doing some spree drinking. He didn't even go to the hospital. I didn't go to the hospital. I came to AA because my father had been in AA. That was the example that had been set for me. So he didn't drink at all for 25 years. Being an being an exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years, retired at the age of 55. People like that piss me off. 55, he's retired. He's set for life. Maybe his life was going to only be to 70 or something like that, at that whatever the age people were dropping dead back then. But, you know, now we're living to 90. So some guy that is able to retire at 55 kind of pisses me off. And he's set. And he's got the house. This is my conception, right? He's got the house. He's got the wife that she's had the boob job and the tux and everything. And so look at what I've done. Look at what I've done. I can have a drink, right? Gets the carpet slippers out, puts the ascot on, the crystal, pinky. Right? In 2 months, he was in a hospital, puzzled and humiliated. Right? Remember what I read on page 24? Most alcoholics have lost the power to choose whether or not they drink. This guy's remained bone dry for 25 years. The progressive nature of alcoholism is his power to choose whether or not he drank was completely eroded when he kicked off the phenomenon of craving. I don't believe that Bill Wilson just pulled this out of his ass. I believe this is a real guy. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital in the meantime. And you know, normally in between the trips to the hospital, you're going to the police station. This is not a walk in the park, and I'm sure that wife is looking at him like, what the hell are you doing? You know, can't you control it? Can't you? Why don't you drink like Joe does or like this guy does? I used to hear that shit all the time, and I'd go get Joe schnockered and go, there's Joe. There you go. I was drinking like Joe. Look, Joe can't handle his alcohol. Now, I used to think that this was kind of a candy-ass example until you get to the last sentence. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly, was dead within 4 years. He's the only guy that I know that drank himself to death in the big book. That's a powerful story. And then it goes on to say, you know, some people are going to be encouraged. Oh, I can do this by myself? Probably not. Probably not. But by all means, I mean, if you think you can do this by yourself, you're wasting your time here. Take your dollar and go do it by yourself. See what happens. See how long you can do it. You know, I used to hear nothing but don't drink and go to meetings. And then I pick up the book, I start reading the book, and it's telling me, you know, if you're not convinced that you're an alcoholic, go try some controlled drinking. Right? Some people are appalled that that's actually in the book, but it's repeated twice. It used to drive me crazy. People coming in, they're relapsing. And I'm like, what are you doing here? Go get the job done. And when it's done, come back here. But all I knew back then was just don't drink and go to meetings. That was working for me. That worked for me for a long time. I was a real pissed off guy, but I wasn't drinking. So the next example is my buddy Jim, who was a guy. He didn't drink until he was 35. I wouldn't have hung with this guy, I'll tell you that. In a few years, he was so violent when intoxicated, he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. And they told him what they knew about alcoholism. You know, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely. If when drinking, you're screwed. You're in a lot of trouble if you are an alcoholic. And the answer that we had, was a god, and it's a god of your conception. I've had people that want to debate about God with me, and I just say, you know, your concept of God sucks. I can't change your concept. You can change your concept. And the only way you're going to change your concept is to really recognize how screwed you are, how desperately you need this higher power in your life. And the best method for growing that higher power is taking these steps, but also seeking. I had to go read a bunch of heady books, and I don't read heady books. I fall asleep with heady books. I had to get them on tape and listen to them while I was driving. You know, C.S. Lewis, Emmett Fox, Anthony DeMello. These guys, you know, Anthony DeMello, his book Awakening, which just blew me away. It's told me that the highest knowledge I will ever have of God is to know God as unknowable. That helped me a lot, because I'm trying to wrap my head around something that's unknowable. That helped me tremendously. But C.S. Lewis, his ideas about the Christianity stories and everything else that I grew up with, just once I could wrap my head around those things, it just helped my concept of God grow from something that was punishing to a loving God that's with me at all times, that's within me, which is what the big book talks about. That at the very end, we're going to find him deep down within ourselves. But what I like to point out is that Jim gets drunk again on numerous occasions because he had made a beginning. He accepted the fact that he was an alcoholic, admitted that he was an alcoholic. Did he make a decision? I don't know. But he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And if you go back to page 15 in Bill's story, it says, actually on page 14, for if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, how do you do that? Through work and self-sacrifice for others. He could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. So in other words, we're going to have trials, we're going to have low spots. Nobody gets sober and goes to AA La La Land where everything is just wonderful. It's still life, life on life's terms. But we come and we laugh at each other about it, you know, about our hardships and stuff. And we tell people, I got people telling me right now, I'm going through some shit. I'm sober 33 years. I got people, you're not going to drink, are you? And I'm like, get the fuck. I'm talking in Westfield tonight. I can't drink tonight. You know, who knows? You never know. So, and I think I've already pointed out, okay, he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. That his story is the purest example of the phenomenon of craving that I find in the big book, where suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, I'm assuming everybody's read these frickin' stories, you know, and that knows them. It couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey, poured it into milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but was reassured I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well. That's the phenomenon of craving. That was brilliant. Mm. The first one didn't seem to hurt me, so I had another. Mm. Which led, once again, to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Started another journey to the asylum. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if he mixed it. We call that pure insanity. Mm. And I'm not even going to go into the Jaywalker. You can read it on your own, because that's not a real guy. That's an analogy. But it makes sense when, especially, maybe it doesn't make sense when you're looking at you, but when you're looking at some of these other people that we come across in AA, it's like, dude's a Jaywalker, man. Look at that guy. He's insane. That's crazy. I've had a couple of Jaywalkers in my life. God bless them. But this, all this seeking, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? How do, oh, what's wrong with me? The actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize to smash home upon the alcoholic's readers as it has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Get out of yourself. What did Bill do? Bill had God in his frickin' hospital room, lighten up and blowing wind through him and everything else. And for the next year and a half, he suffered from depression and self-pity and, oh, can't get out of bed. And when he was almost on the verge of taking a drink, he would go back to the hospital and Silkworth would point a guy to him and he would go tell his story to this guy. And the guy would look at him like, are you crazy? The wind blowing through and everything. And Bill said, I was always amazingly lifted up and put on my feet. It's a design for living that works. When I walked out of Morris County Jail on Friday night, I was amazingly lifted up and put back on my feet. However, how do you get the opportunity to come to Westfield and sit in this seat? How do you get the opportunity to go? Let me tell you something. These guys aren't going to listen to a bunch of bullshit up at Morris County Jail. And they certainly don't listen to a bunch of bullshit up at Northern State Prison. You have to have a message that has depth and weight. How do you develop a message that has depth and weight? You live with restlessness, irritability, discontent, and you get to midnight one day at a time without picking up a drink or a drug, and you will develop a message that has depth and weight. Learn what's in this book. Learn AA history. If you don't know AA history and what's in this book, you don't know AA from the bullshit. Because what this dust jacket tells me is that this fellowship took its name from this book, not vice versa. This book is not named after us. We're named after it. And I continue to dig into the history of Alcoholics Anonymous to cut through the bullshit that goes on in the discussion meetings. I'm not saying that, like I say, some people bug me, but they have every right to present their conceptions in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's up to me to recognize what's what for me. And maybe I'll grab a sponsee and go, dude, don't listen to that shit over there, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, the people that used to tell, oh, AA's full of non-alcoholics. What the fuck are you talking about? They never took the steps. Oh, and the early members of AA, they were marching arm in arm and they were all doing the same thing. Bullshit, they were doing the same thing. You ever hear the story about Clarence Schneider? Clarence Schneider, the old brewmeister, you got to go back to the third edition of the Big Book to read his story. But this guy he invited Bill Wilson out to this big dinner out to Cleveland. He started AA in Cleveland. And the reason he started AA in Cleveland is because he was going to the Oxford Group in Akron. And the guys he was bringing, there were a bunch of Polacks and a bunch of Irish guys. And they were all Catholic. And their priests were telling them, well, you're going to be excommunicated if you're going to that Episcopalian Oxford Group thing. And Clarence came and said, hey, I can't bring my... He used to call them his babies. I can't bring my babies out to the meet because they're going to get excommunicated. And Dr. Bob said, what are we supposed to do about it? We're not keeping them out. And Clarence came back the next week and said, we started our own meeting. And we're going to call it Alcoholics Anonymous after that stupid book that was just published. And he was running around telling everybody he started Alcoholics Anonymous, right? As opposed to Bill and Bob, because Bob was still in the Oxford Group. Bill was, quote unquote, had his AA meetings going on at his house. But this is the kind of shit that went on back then. And let me tell you, the Cleveland group, the Akron group tried to break up the meeting of the Cleveland group the next week. These guys didn't mind driving a long way to mess with each other. And as Clarence tells in one of his stories, he got kicked out of the Cleveland group within a year and had to start another group. And that's how we grow. That's how we grow. We put bugs up each other's asses and we go, screw those guys, I'm going to go start this meeting over here. I'm going to do it my way. This is the way I think it should be done. That's how we grow. I'm just going to you know, we agnostics, we had lack of power is our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. And it had, obviously it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Where are people like us going to find this higher power? Oh, wait. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, who can do for you what you can't do. Before I came into AA, my father had passed away. He had 13 years sobriety when he passed away. A year and a half later, I went to my first AA meeting. I've told the story. Within 2 weeks, I'm feeling all alone in AA because I really don't fit in. Either you didn't drink as much as I did, or holy shit, I didn't drink like you. I wasn't going to the Liberty drugstore to buy mouthwash on Sunday morning because to get the alcohol, and you know, maybe I don't belong here. But I kept going to meetings every night. I got involved. I made coffee. I was a secretary of a group, all this stuff. But before all of this, there was one night my mom asked me to go to a dinner at her church, the Long Hill Chapel in Chatham Township. These are a bunch of Jesus freaks. Let me just warn you about this story right off the bat. I knew it, and I was not happy about it, but I was the oldest son. So what was I to do? I said, sure, Mom, I'm going to go. And I got home a little bit late from work. I had my jacket and tie on, and I didn't have time to smoke a joint. I didn't have time to have a drink. I was, oh, you got to be ready. They're coming. Who's coming? They're coming. They're coming. They're picking us up. Oh, great. Okay. They pull into the driveway. Young couple, very successful. They live on the next block over. This is a very nice house in Chathamboro. And they drive us out to Chatham Township to this dinner. And I'm at this dinner, and I'm sitting there, and my skin is crawling. And I'm looking at these people. They're intelligent, and they're driving nice cars, and they're well-dressed. And I'm thinking, what are you people doing here on a Wednesday night? What is the attraction of this? And I excused myself. I said, Mom, I'm going to go smoke a cigarette. Okay, go outside. I'm smoking a cigarette. Outside, the people smoking cigarettes are praising Jesus and doing all that. And I'm like, oh, I can't get away from this. This is horrible. And I go back in, and the dinner starts, and there's a speaker. And the speaker, it's an attorney and his wife, his pretty blonde wife. And he's telling his story about how Jesus has come into his life. And I'm like, just kill me. Just shoot me in the head. Oh, my God, this is horrible. And he goes, I'm going to pass this clipboard around. If anybody's asked Jesus Christ to be the Lord and Savior, just write your name down on the clipboard. And I'm thinking, you could take that clipboard and stick it up your ass. Keep that fucking thing away from me. I don't want any part of this. And the clipboard starts coming around the table. And I'm like, oh, shit, okay. And it comes to me, and I'm ready to do one of these. Boom. But she's talking to her. And I'm thinking, maybe I can just slide it across, but he's talking to him, and he's talking to him, and I got this, and I'm looking at this guy, and this guy's, he's picking his nose or something, and I got this clipboard. And to this day, I can't tell you why, but I wrote my name down on that clipboard. And as soon as I did, she's looking at me like, are you going to pass me the clipboard? And I'm like, here, take the freaking clipboard. And I walked out of that meeting that night. And I said, you stupid asshole, you used your real name. How could you be so stupid? They're going to want you to come and shake the tambourine while they're setting up the tents. They're going to put you on the circuit. Well, you idiot. How could you be? They know who your mother is, you stupid idiot. Nobody ever contacted me. They were supposed to send me a pair of Jesus socks or something like that. They never contacted me. They never contacted me. But one night I was coming from a speaking commitment up in Morristown, and I was driving past that church. And I was thinking, that uncomfortability, the resentment, the uncomfortability came back to me. Remember that night that you were there? Remember those Jesus freaks? Remember the stuff that they were talking about? Oh, my God, that was hard. And then a little voice in my head just said, do you remember what that guy said? You remember you signed that clipboard? Do you remember what that guy said before you signed? If anybody's asked Jesus Christ to be the Lord and Savior, just take this little action. And all I was appalled. I said, they thought I was serious. Shit. What does this mean? Why couldn't it have been Buddha or something cool like that, you know? Not Jesus. That's like a big joke. And probably for the next 10 years, it just messed with me until I started. I had to go to C.S. Lewis. I had to go to Emmett Fox. I had to go find out what this was because I had signed that stupid clipboard. And my life had changed 180 degrees after signing that clipboard, thinking it was stupid. I took an action thinking this is ridiculous. And you know, this chapter, we agnostics. You know what? Any agnostics in here? Any? Okay. You know what agnostic means? Without knowledge. Thank you. We got a freaking chapter in our book called We Agnostics, and nobody puts their hands up. You know, because people think agnostic, well, I don't, but... No, Google it. Google the freaking word. There's a spectrum of agnosticism. I can't say it, but there is a spectrum, and it's... I have no knowledge of God, and I'm going to live my life like God is nothing. Or, I have no knowledge of God. I'm going to live my life like God is everything. Most of us fall someplace within this. You know, there was one guy that said he knew God and they nailed him to a tree. So watch it. Right? Without knowledge. How do we deal with this? How do we deal with this? When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could no longer postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition. My teeth are loose. God is either everything or He is nothing. He either is or He isn't. What was our choice to be? My favorite paragraph in the whole frickin' book, page 53. When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could no longer postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition, God is either everything or He is nothing. He either is or He isn't. What was our choice to be? That, I think, is the second step. Of course, if you can't handle it, do you now believe or are you willing to believe that there's a power greater than yourself? As soon as a person says they do, let's move on. And where do we move on to from there? Well, from there, if you want a summary, A, I'm an alcoholic and I can't manage my own life. B, that probably no human power could relieve my alcoholism. C, that God could and would if He were sought. Are you convinced of those three pertinent ideas? If you are, where are you? Step three. Okay. People get all twisted up. How do I turn my will and my life over to the care of God? How do I do this? Oh, do I just stay at home and just let Him do everything? How do I do this? Read the step. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. Laura, there are five frogs sitting on a log. Five frickin' frogs sitting on a log. Three of them decide to jump off. How many frogs are on the log? Five. Why? They made a freaking decision. Now, if you're standing on the corner and you decide to cross the street, if you don't take a step to cross, if you don't start walking, you're still standing on the curb. Your decision is worthless. Is worthless. How do you know you've made the decision? You got a pencil in your hand, you got a yellow legal pad, and you're writing down who you're pissed off at. Who hurts you? You get into the work. It's that simple. The third step is nothing more than making the decision to go on with the process. But there's a lot of good stuff in that how it works. Don't just read that stuff that we read before all those meetings. Read about the actor that wants to direct the show. Read about how he suffers from the delusion he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he just manages well. Mm-hmm. Right? I catch myself all the time. Today I'm going to buckle down. I'm going to do this. Today, oh, I got to figure out what I'm saying tonight in Westfield. Oh, I got to do this. Bullshit. Get up here, wing it. You know, but God couldn't would if he was saw it. I spend a little bit of time every morning doing my readings, not this reading, the big book. I read that stuff that used to just like go so far over my head. I've exposed myself to all this different philosophies and everything else. And it's just asking God that, here, you take this. You take this. Because guess what? I'm still crushed by self-imposed crises that I can't postpone or evade. Self-imposed. I bring this shit on myself. I'm still bringing shit on myself. 33 years sober. But I'll tell you, my next drink is pushed so far away right now that I would have to really be slothful to have that sucker catch up with me. Because I got commitments coming up on Northern State Prison next week, Morris County Jail the week after that, and just, you know, it just keeps rolling. And these guys are going to, not Patrick's not going to show up at my house tomorrow night, but hopefully his father's going to show up at my house tomorrow night, have a meeting there, you know. And what do? We read the big book. And it's not as it's not as I see it, it's as the group sees it. Everybody's going to share about what the reading meant to them. And, it's a great thing. It's a great way of life. And God's been taking such good care of me. Really has. And don't be afraid to throw yourself into this program. Don't think that, oh, I got too much to do. To screw the stuff you have to do. This is a path with a heart. And I'm glad that I'm on the path, and I hope you guys are too. Thanks. That's all I got.